This is 89.9 WWNL. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for a sonic experience delving into royal madness or a haunting drama involving a family heirloom, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. The Louisiana premiere of Sir Peter Maxwell Davies' monodrama Eight Songs for a Mad King and works by contemporary masters and emerging composers will highlight the Louis Morrow Institute's 2020 festival. Artistic director Morris Rosenzweig and bass baritone Jonathan Z. Harris are here with the details. Welcome to Inside the Arts.
Delighted to be here.
Congratulations on your sixth season.
Yes, it's pretty wonderful that we've been able to make it this far, that we were able to start it all, and that we are continuing with momentum, thanks to a lot of people.
Tell us about the Louis Morrow Institute for New Music Performance. Is the name a nod to the composer, Louis Morrow Gottschalk?
Well, it's got a number of names sort of wrapped up in it, but it certainly alludes to Louis Morrow Gottschalk, but it also refers to Louis Armstrong. The idea behind the Institute is twofold. One is that we want to give a selected group of performers the opportunity to have a professional experience. We're referring to people who are early career professionals themselves. Typically, they have finished graduate programs in music and haven't quite gotten to that place where they've landed a permanent adult-style post. And so being in that situation is very precarious, and anything that helps to make a little bit of a bridge is helpful. So we want to make that happen. The other part is we want to bring repertory to the very rich menu of musical offerings that exists in New Orleans already, and expand it a bit. It's very good music, all of it. It's very different, and it's also rather diverse in terms of it being, let's say, contemporary music, but it's not all the same type of contemporary music.
Now, you open this year's festival with the local premiere of Sir Peter Davies' Eight Songs for a Mad King. This work shocked audiences when it premiered in the 1960s. Let's talk about this British composer first. Who was he?
Peter Maxwell Davies was a young English composer at one time and was sort of coming into his own in the 60s. But he, at this point, I think, hooked up with the idea of experimentation, the idea of expanding the possibilities of the human voice. That intersected with him running into a bass baritone who could make the sounds that he wanted to have in the piece. That coincidence also linked up to him discovering or working with someone to get the text for the piece, which are, in many cases, literal words spoken by King George III, who suffered from a malady whose side effects included mental instability and some uncontrollable body motions. And so the music was meant to reflect the mental state of this individual who was struggling to still be king, struggling to keep his wits about him. And it goes many different ways, as one can imagine that a fantastic mental landscape might go.
Is this considered a musical parody?
Part of the music is parody. There are things that are well known in it. There are quotes from the Messiah, some of which are clear, some of which are rather cloaked. And there is a lot of music, kind of anonymous music from the time as well. But an awful lot of it just has to do with expanding the sounds that the instruments can make into what we would call, perhaps, well, certainly non-traditional, but some might even say non-musical sounds. Just start, making a sound on a flute where you can't tell what note is actually being played.
Jonathan, this is where your bass baritone comes in.
Yeah.
What is challenging for you?
This is probably the single hardest piece I've ever tried to learn. musically the number of colors and different sounds that are required of the voice. My training in opera and classical singing is to use the voice in a very particular way, and this calls for all kinds of modes of production, from growls to near shrieks to everything in between, and some moments of relatively straightforward singing.
Green snakes of ivy pythons.
So just in terms of the musical production of it, that is its own challenge. And even understanding the notation on the page has been a huge challenge for me, because all of these techniques that I'm not used to working in vocally also had to be notated in some way. And there isn't a standard musical notation for these sounds.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, at the time, Peter Maxwell Davies and Roy Hart, the gentleman who premiered the piece, sort of came up with really, I think, just their own shorthand for it. And it's up to those of us who perform it now to make what we can of it and try to figure out what it all means. It goes from incredibly low to incredibly high, certainly lower and higher than I've ever tried to perform on the stage. And multiphonics.
Meaning what?
Roy Hart was able to sing multiple pitches at once. And the piece calls for that.
So now, what will be this experience? Tell us, how does this work unfold?
It is divided into 8 songs. It begins with what sounds like noise, crashing and all kinds of noise from the ensemble. It really sort of gives you a good sense of what you're in for right from the beginning. King George begins with some of these sort of multiphonic sounds, going from the very low all the way to the highest squeaks that he's got. Through each song, he sort of is speaking to a different, say, person in the room. At one point, it's a lady in waiting. At another point, it's the River Thames, not exactly a person. He is really trying to wrap his mind around his situation. He knows that he's mad. He knows that he's not really in control of his mind.
Why are there cages on the stage?
Well, it's a series of vignettes, the piece. And then the third one is him talking to a bird or a series of birds. And so we have the players in cages as if they were birds.
And George did have a number of bullfinches that he kept in cages, and he was actually trying to teach these birds to sing. I think one of the reasons that Handel is quoted in this piece is that George did love the music of Handel and actually was trying to teach his bullfinches to sing snippets by Handel.
Do audiences still find this work shocking?
Yes. What I think is shocking is the sonic world. It's a lot of sounds that we're not used to hearing, whether it be from the instrumentalists or from the vocalist. I think what really is engaging and makes it accessible is the fact that the sound world is such an incredible depiction of madness and of trauma and of what George is experiencing, that, you know, it's really possible to get inside his mind and empathize with him.
Now, tell me, what else is on this particular program?
There is a piece by Gabriele Franck, who is the composer in residence with the Philadelphia Orchestra. It is a cello quartet. The cellists for this are members of the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra, and it's a surrealistic Spanish piece. There's a work for 3 instruments by Elliot Carter, written late in his life, and he had a very long life indeed, 104 years,
wow,
and wrote music until he was 102. This is one of his later pieces, a piece for flute and live electronics. It's a very lovely piece. Kaija Saariaho is a Finnish composer in her 60s. As is our tradition, we do a New Orleans kind of piece. We've done all sorts. This year, it's Louis Armstrong's version of Fats Waller's Alligator Crawl.
And your closing concert on March 12th will be quite different. What can we look forward to?
Yeah, this one doesn't have anyone playing a role on the stage. It's a collection of recent works, all delightful, all quite different. The first is by Thomas Addis, a very successful British composer, 3 mazurkas. Last summer, a very important Argentine-born American composer. Mario Davidovsky died at age 85. He wrote music for different ensembles during his lifetime, but perhaps his most important contribution are the works that he wrote for acoustic instruments and electronics. Mario was on the Louis board, and so we are acknowledging with great sadness his passing and also celebrating his contributions by doing his last synchronism, the one for clarinet and fixed media, as they call it. In other words, pre-recorded tape part that the clarinetist has to interchange with. A New Orleans-based composer, Anna Louise Walton, her work called Uttered. One of the really great composers of modern music, George Ligeti. It's an early work of his, Sonata for Solo Cello. It's not a long work, but it's very, very pretty. A kind of controlled chaos piece, not quite on the order of eight songs, by yet another Englishman, Jonathan Harvey, The Riot. Arnold Schoenberg, we're doing Fantasy for Violin Piano. Of course, we'll be doing Alligator Crawl again, and then closing with a delightful piece by David Froom called Hidden Motives.
What are you hoping people will take away from these concerts?
If nothing else, curiosity. I think probably everybody has had an experience where they've tasted something that they've never tasted before, and it was just beyond what you thought was, you know, in the normal realm. That's what I would like people to take away, which is we tried something different. Some of it was, some of it was nice, and some of it was, wow, I got to do that again.
Artistic director Morris Rosenzweig and bass baritone Jonathan Z. Harris, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Our pleasure.
Thank you so much.
The Louis Morrow Institute for New Music Performance opens its 2020 festival with Sir Peter Maxwell Davies' monodrama, Eight Songs for a Mad King, along with other works, Monday, March 9th at the Marigny Opera House. The festival concludes with a concert of contemporary masters on Thursday, March 12th, in Tulane University's Dixon Hall. More info is online at louismorrowinstitute.org. Now, if you want a sneak peek, there will be a meet-and-greet concert preview on Friday, March 6th at the Brew Carré, 2115 Decatur Street. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. August Wilson's Pulitzer Prize-winning play, The Piano Lesson, continues the season for the Petit Theater. It is an intimate story of a family's struggle with an heirloom and a quest to break free of their past. Cast members Lance Nichols and Zeb Hollins III are here with all the details. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
The title of this work begs the question, what can one learn from a family heirloom, a piano?
This is Zeb. It's really a ghost story, and it's a sort of about those things that might haunt us. And so there are several lessons throughout the play. Of course, I don't want to give away the lesson, but for me, it has become a ghost story framed within African-American culture from the early 1930s, and it's about some of the ghosts that might haunt us or things that we may need to learn from the haunting.
This is Lance. For me, it's also how an object can have different meanings to different people. Some person may have an emotional attachment to an object, but to someone else, that has a higher meaning for them.
Wilson takes us back to 1936, Pittsburgh, right after the Great Depression. Many of his works are set in Pittsburgh's African-American communities. What is his connection to the area? Tell us a little bit about him.
August Wilson was actually born and sort of grew up in Pittsburgh. So these stories that he tells and the cycle of plays that he wrote were actually from personal experiences, some from people that he actually knew.
The storytellers are primarily African-American male in the play. And so I think that organically is a connection to Wilson himself.
And a lot of his characters, I feel, are sort of larger than life, each in their own individual way. But they're also people that I think that we in the African community, we will recognize someone from his plays. We'll go, oh my God, that's my Uncle Joe. That's my Aunt so-and-so.
And the storytelling and the oral tradition and the lore and the folklore that happens within the play.
And the piano itself is a larger-than-life character.
Oh, absolutely. There's a lot of history in the piano, literally on the piano.
Right. It's been carved into the piano. It's the story of the Charles family, literally carved into the piano, which sort of led to the family owning or taking ownership of the piano.
So let's set the stage. What's being explored?
There's a dispute between Boy Willie and his sister Bernice over ownership of the piano. Each of them own the piano equally, half and half. Bernice wants to keep the piano, and Boy Willie wants to sell the piano because he wants some of that money to buy some land that his ancestors sort of did farming on back in the day.
And were enslaved on.
And so that is the crux of the dispute between the brother and sister. It's a sibling dispute as to who has ownership of that particular piano.
And when the play opens, Boy Willie has just come up from Mississippi with a truckload of watermelons, about 500 watermelons, his uncle, my character, Doker, says in the play. And he wants to sell those watermelons so he can get part of the money to buy the land. He's earned part of the money, and if he could sell the piano, he would have the third part. But there's a haunting. A man named Sutter, a white slave owner's grandson, and the grandfather owned the Charles family throughout their history being in America. So there's a haunting, and this Sutter person has just fallen in as well.
Right. And so Sutter's spirit is still present in the Charles household.
And although Bernice wants to keep the piano, she doesn't play the piano since Mama Ola, another character, passed. And so Boy Willie's like, you don't play on it, you don't use it, but she wants to keep it.
I play a character named Whining Boy. And Whining Boy is actually Doker's brother. There were three brothers. Whining Boy has left the South, and he's moved up to Kansas City, and he's a ladies' man. He's a gambler. Was married, but that didn't work out because he couldn't keep his hands and eyes off the other merchandise, so to speak. So he comes in and out of the play. Sometimes Doker doesn't see them for months. He just disappears, and he comes back, and he's always coming back saying he's got a pocket full of money, but yet he's always asking people, can you loan me $5? Can you loan me this, loan me that? So he's kind of a drifter, and that's all I'll say about him.
My character, Doker, is the youngest brother, and he's the only brother that doesn't have Boy as a part of his name. There's Whining Boy, there's Boy Charles, there's the nephew Boy Willie. But Doker is sort of solid. Someone suggested sort of like an oak. And he's the sort of storyteller in the play. He's connecting and threading it because he's survived it all. He's a railroad worker. He's worked for the railroad for 27 years. He goes back and forth down south. And he tells the story, some might say articulates the piano lesson. He drinks a lot. He lives with Bernice. There's a little confusion whether or not he owns the house or Bernice owns the house, but the piano's been brought up.
Is there something that you can share from the production with us?
All right. So let's start with the first scene. Yeah. All right. Here we go. So the ghost of the yellow dog got set. That just go to show you I believe I always live right. They say every dog gonna have his day and time it go around and sure come back to you. I done seen that 1,000 times. I know the truth of that. But I tell you outright, if I see Sutter's ghost, I'll be on the first thing I find that got wheels on it.
Whining Boy.
And I tell you another thing. Bernice ain't gonna sell that piano.
That's what she told him. He said he gonna cut it in half and go and sell his half. They've been around here 3 days trying to sell them watermelons. They trying to get out to where the white folks live, but the truck keep breaking down. They go a block or two and they break down again. They trying to get out the Squirrel Hill and can't get around the corner. He say as soon as he get that truck empty to where he can set that piano up there, he gonna take it on out of here and go sell it.
What about them boys Sutter got? How come they ain't farming that land?
One of them going to school. He left down there and come north to school. The other one ain't got as much sense as that frying pan over yonder. That is the dumbest white man I ever seen. He'd stand in the river and watch it rise till it drowned him.
Other than seeing Sutter's ghost, how's Bernice doing?
Well, she all right. Well, she still got Crawley on her mind. He been dead 3 years, but she's still holding on to him. She need to go on out here and get one of these fellows, let them grab a whole handful of whatever she got. She think it ain't got precious.
They always told me any fish will bite if you got good bait.
Well, she stuck up on it. She thinks it's better than she is. Two brothers. At the table having a couple of drinks.
Talking men talk.
Who else is in the cast?
Oh, my God. We have a wonderful cast.
Jarrell Hamilton, Lauren Turner.
Meryl Burkett, Reno.
McClinton.
And then a wonderful, wonderful director from Northern California named Dawn Monique Williams, an African-American director who's terrific.
I wanted to also mention the young girl, Maritha, is played by Gail King. There's also Brian DeMond Williams, who was just in Something Rotten at La Boutique. He played Shakespeare. And so I wanted to make sure we mentioned those names as well.
How do you hope the piano lesson will speak to today's audiences?
I would like for today's audiences to connect to the storytelling, the oral tradition, what I grew up with. My father and my mother told stories all the time, and really just to sort of sit there and hear it and absorb it. It's based in reality, but it's a ghost story, and really just to hear the story, the oral tradition, and to absorb that.
And for me, it's the importance of family, and that's what I like about all of August's plays. Each of them is set in some sort of family and the struggles that families go through and what either keeps them together or tears them apart.
Actors Lance Nichols and Zeb Hollins III, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
August Wilson's Pulitzer Prize winning play, The Piano Lesson, runs March 6th through 22nd at Liberty Theater, 616 St. Peter Street. More info is online at LibertyTheater.com. That's our show for this week. Major support for Inside the Arts comes from the Hellas Foundation. Additional support comes from Le Petit Theatre. Our program is a production of WWNO and is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette on Tuesdays at 1 p.m., Wednesdays at 8:30 p.m., and a shortened edition on Thursday mornings at 8:45 when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.